the station bringing you Tag for Swag.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Katie Weaver and Andrew Smith tell us about one of the longest-serving employees at the White House in Washington, D.C. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's Technology Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here are Katie and Andrew.
American presidents come and go through the White House. But one man has served there for the last 50 years, alongside 10 presidents, their families, and even their dogs and cats. He is Dale Haney, the chief White House groundskeeper. Haney's main responsibility is to care for the grounds, flower gardens, hundreds of trees, thousands of plants, and a growing vegetable garden. He also chooses the official White House Christmas tree every year. Haney has already identified this year's tree at a Pennsylvania farm. This week, President Joe Biden and his wife, Jill, surprised Haney by planting a tree in his name on the grounds he has cared for these many years. At a planting ceremony in Haney's honor, Biden said that future visitors to the White House are going to be looking at this tree and asking, "Who's Dale?" In answer, Haney joked that he might still be here.
Haney is perhaps better known to many at the White House as the keeper of the president's pets. These days, Haney is often seen walking Commander, the Biden's German Shepherd dog. The first thing that I think about when I think about Dale is his relationship with the First Family's animals, said Gary Walters, who has served under 4 presidents in 20 years as White House Chief Usher. Walters spoke of Haney's service during the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. An order was issued to evacuate the White House while President George W. Bush was in Florida. Walters said, "And there was Dale standing with Barney, the dog, under one arm and Kitty Cat under the other." The two animals were then reunited with First Lady Laura Bush in a safe area.
Haney was training to work in the gardens at a museum in Washington in 1972 when the White House called. The administration was looking for a groundskeeper. He took the job during Richard Nixon's presidency and planned to stay for just 2 years. He had a bachelor's degree in horticulture and wanted to go back to school to continue his studies. "When I accepted the job, I agreed to stay for 2 years," he said in an interview with White House History Quarterly, a publication of the White House Historical Association. "But the time has gone by so fast that it really doesn't feel like 50 years," Haney said. He and his team are so busy that, in his words, "it has been easy to forget that time is passing. No day is ever the same, and every day brings challenges.
Haney, who turns 71 on November 4th, has witnessed many historic events at the House. He watched Nixon leave the White House by helicopter after he resigned in 1974. He saw President Jimmy Carter overseeing the signing of a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel in 1979. And then there was the plane crash on the White House grounds in 1994 and the evacuation on 9/11. Haney also was around for President Barack Obama's Beer Summit in 2009 and President Donald Trump's hosting of the Republican National Convention on the South Lawn in 2020. He walked the grounds for 50 years of the White House Easter egg roll. And there were state arrival ceremonies for world leaders, including three visits by Queen Elizabeth II and three different popes. And Haney will be there when the White House grounds will hold a wedding on November 19th for Biden's granddaughter, Naomi.
First families sometimes work with Haney on projects involving the White House grounds. Most recently, he helped Melania Trump add a structure by the tennis court and redo the famous Rose Garden. His meticulous attention to detail always ensures and preserves the beauty of the White House grounds for many to enjoy, she told the Associated Press. Haney also helped Michelle Obama create her garden, which continues to provide vegetables, fruits, and herbs for the White House. Laura Bush called Haney the best friend to all the animals. She told the AP that the Bush family dogs loved him more than they loved us. Former President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle sent Haney a letter thanking him for bringing his passion and expertise to the difficult job of caring for the White House grounds. They added, "We will also never forget how wonderfully you cared for Sonny and Beau, the family's dogs. Indeed, you have made and lived history," Bill and Hillary Clinton and daughter Chelsea wrote in a note to Haney, which they shared with the AP.
Haney was one of the first people Deborah Dunn met after she was put in charge of the White House Visitor's Office under President George Bush in 1989. Easter came early that year, she said, and only one member of her small office had experience planning events for 30,000 people. But Haney talked her through some of the planning and set her up with some workers who could help. Dunn remembered how she also worried about the setting for a Halloween event. Haney told her about a large pumpkin from a past celebration that was sitting in storage. "How would I have known that existed?" she said in a telephone call with the AP. "He was just my guiding star." I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Facebook parent company Meta has built a technology tool designed to directly translate spoken speech from one language to another. Meta recently released a video that demonstrated how the artificial intelligence AI-powered tool can translate between English and the Hokkien language. In the video, Meta chief Mark Zuckerberg explained that the project required different, unusual development methods. That is because Hokkien is mainly a spoken language. It does not have a widely used written form. Generally, developers of translation systems train AI models on very large amounts of written text in the target languages. This arms the system with many different language examples and combinations in an effort to produce the most correct results. In general, AI-powered translation systems have improved greatly in recent years. It is now easier than ever to get translation help online or on devices to make international communication better. But one problem with such systems is that there are delays linked to the translation process. For example, when the system records spoken speech, the words are first converted into text and then translated by an AI system. Then the translated words are converted back into speech so they can be heard. The unusual part of the META project is that the development team did not have large amounts of Hokkien language text to feed into the AI system. Hokkien is a version or dialect of Chinese. It is spoken by millions of people in the southeastern Chinese province of Fujian. It is also spoken by many people in Taiwan and some communities in Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines. The language is generally passed down through generations of families. META notes that Hokkien is one of nearly 3,500 living languages that are mainly spoken and do not have a widely used writing system. The company says its AI developers are aiming to create speech-to-speech translation tools that would cover most of the world's languages. Earlier this year, META announced two new AI projects. One is called No Language Left Behind. Zuckerberg said in a video that effort is designed to create translation systems to cover hundreds of world languages. The other is called the Universal Speech Translator. The goal of that project is to build a system that can produce speech-to-speech translation across all languages, the company said in a statement. META's latest system involving Hokkien was developed as part of its Universal Speech Translator project. The ability to communicate with anyone in any language, that's a superpower people have dreamed of forever, and AI is going to deliver that within our lifetimes, Zuckerberg said. META said it used several different methods to create the new system to translate to and from Hokkien and English. The team trained its AI models on written text examples from another version of Chinese, Mandarin, which is similar to Hokkien. In addition, META developers used an encoding tool designed to compare spoken Hokkien to similar English text. The team also worked closely with Hokkien speakers to make sure the results were correct. META said it aims to use the same methods used for Hokkien to create speech-to-speech translation systems for many more languages in the future. I'm Brian Lin.
from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. President James Madison retired after 8 years in office. His Republican Party chose another Virginian, James Monroe, as its next presidential candidate. The opposition Federalist Party had almost disappeared by the time of the election in 1816. James Monroe easily won the election, but not everyone was happy with the result. After all, Monroe was the fourth president from the state of Virginia. The situation caused hard feelings among political leaders in other areas, especially the states of New England. Monroe sought to improve this situation. He wanted to give the top four jobs in his cabinet to men from each of the nation's four major areas: the Northeast, the South, the West, and the Middle Atlantic coast. But he could find no Westerner who would take the job as head of the War Department. So he had cabinet ministers from only three of the four areas. The West was not represented. Despite the political concerns, most Americans liked Monroe and welcomed his presidency. Historian Harlow Giles Unger has written more than 20 books, including one about James Monroe. Mr. Unger says Monroe was one of America's most beloved presidents. He had been Secretary of State and Secretary of War at the same time under President Madison. He had also been a diplomat under President Thomas Jefferson and helped carry out the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the country. And Monroe had fought in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812.
So Monroe came out of the War of 1812 as a hero, and he and his wife, his beautiful wife Elizabeth, moved into what was a blackened hulk of a presidential mansion. And workers slathered on, really slathered on these thick, thick coats of white paint, and really so thick that it gleamed white.
Harlow Unger says the new president sought to improve the country's safety. Monroe wanted to prevent any more invasions and to extend the country's natural defenses. One of the first problems he faced was in East Florida, in land which is now part of the state of Florida. The area borders the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, East Florida belonged to Spain, but Spain controlled only a few towns in the area. The rest was controlled by criminals, escaped slaves, and former British soldiers. The area was also home to Native American Indians of the Seminole and Creek tribes. Sometimes people from East Florida would enter the state of Georgia and attack American citizens. One serious fight involved Seminole Indians and people just across the Georgia border. Monroe ordered General Andrew Jackson to march against the Indians. Jackson was a hero of the War of 1812 against Britain. He sent a message to President Monroe. It said, "Let me know in any way that the United States wants possession of the Florida Territory, and in 60 days it will be done." Jackson received no answer to his letter. He believed the silence meant that he was free to seize Florida. He quickly gathered a force of soldiers and marched toward Florida. General Jackson failed to capture any Indians, but he seized two Spanish towns, St. Mark's and Pensacola. He also arrested two British subjects. The two men were tried by a military court. They were found guilty of spying and giving guns to the Indians. Both were executed. President Monroe called a cabinet meeting as soon as he learned of Jackson's actions. All the ministers, except Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, believed that Jackson had gone too far, but they decided not to denounce him in public. Secretary Adams prepared messages to Britain and Spain about the incidents. His message to Britain carefully stated the activities of the two British subjects in Florida and explained why they were executed. Britain agreed not to take any action. Adams' message to Spain explained the situation this way. Spain had failed to keep the peace along the border as it had promised to do in a treaty. The United States had sent soldiers into Florida only to defend its citizens on the American side. The United States recognized that Florida belonged to Spain, but if Americans were forced to enter Florida again in self-defense, the United States might not return the territory to Spain. Spain had a choice. It could send enough soldiers to keep order in Florida, or it could give Florida to the United States. Spain really had no choice. At that time, Spain's colonies in South America were rebelling. All had declared their independence. José de San Martín led the struggle in Argentina. Bernardo O'Higgins was in Chile. And Simón Bolívar created the Republic of Great Colombia in the north. Spain's forces could not be sent to Florida. They were needed in South America. So the King of Spain agreed to give Florida to the United States. In exchange, the United States agreed to pay $5 million to American citizens who had damage claims against Spain. Historian Harlow Unger says the negotiations with Spain led to more than just Florida. He says President Monroe and Spanish officials also agreed on the boundaries of the Louisiana Purchase. They set the boundaries on the very top of the Rocky Mountains in the central west of the United States. The mountains created a natural border. Mr. Unger says they extended American territory into the northwest edge of the continent to what are now the states of Washington and Oregon. In other words, he says, Monroe moved the American frontier to the Pacific Ocean.
He really stretched the nation into an empire that reached from sea to shining sea.
With the new growth of the nation, tens of thousands of people began moving west. They built houses, started farms, and created towns.
And it was the first time in world history, really, that any sovereign state had granted so much land to people that were not of noble birth. And this expanded the strength of the American population. For the first time now, thousands, tens of thousands of Americans became landowners. With the ownership of land, these people were now, Americans, thousands of them, were now able to vote for the first time, were able to run for office for the first time, and really direct the course of their communities and their nations. It empowered the American people, and they absolutely worshipped Monroe for his efforts.
Harlow Unger says that with the strength and unity of the American people behind him, Monroe could make an important decision about international relations. The issue was the rebelling Spanish colonies in South America. The King of Spain did not want the United States to recognize the colonies' independence, and Spain asked European countries to help it put down the rebellions. Britain wanted no part of the Spanish proposal. It was trading heavily with these new Latin American countries. Spanish or even French control of this area would destroy or limit this trade. So Britain proposed a joint statement with the United States to say that neither country wanted any of Spain's territory in the New World. Britain also wanted the United States to join in opposing the handover of any of Spain's American territories to any other power in Europe. Most of President Monroe's advisors urged him to accept the British offer. Secretary of State Adams opposed it. He did not believe the United States should tie itself to any European power, even Britain. Monroe accepted the advice of his Secretary of State. He included Adams' ideas in his message to Congress in December 1823. This part of the message became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The president said no European power should, in the future, try to establish a colony anywhere in the Americas. He said the political system of the European powers was very different from that of the Americas. Monroe said any attempt to extend this European system to any of the Americas would threaten the peace and safety of the United States. The president also said the United States had not interfered with the colonies of any European power in South America and would not do so in the future. But Monroe added, a number of these former colonies had become independent countries, and the United States had recognized their independence. We would see it as an unfriendly act, he said, for any European power to try to oppress or control these new American countries in any way. At the same time, Monroe said, the United States never had and never would take part in any war among the European powers. This statement by Monroe was only part of a presidential message to Congress, but it clearly stated one of the most important of America's foreign policies. The country was enjoying a time of good feelings under Monroe, but an old problem was about to return and divide the country again. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.